Kids These Days.
Kids These Days.
This is Kids These Days.
Many parts of Alaska have experienced the snowiest winter in years, but despite the piles of white stuff that you might be looking at out your window right now, can you feel it? Spring is coming. Today on the program, we're talking about springtime and the seasonal period of renewal that transforms our land and affects us all. I'm talking with in-studio guests about how our bodies respond to spring, and with an outdoor expert who can give Alaskans practical advice about getting outdoors this time of year. Also this hour, we learn about gardening with kids, and we find out about Alaska's seasonal spikes in mood disorders and the dangers that can come with those. And a spring skiing KTD on the go today. All that and more this hour, so stay with us. Hi, I'm Shannon Sheehy. Kids These Days today is about the turn of the season. Spring is coming, and winter, while it might take some time to melt away this year, it's nearing its end. We want to know what spring means to you. Do you rebound this time of year? Do you wear shorts way too early to be comfortable? Do you plan trips out of state to deliberately miss breakup? Or maybe you have an annual spring skiing tradition in your family. Or maybe springtime is a tough time for you emotionally. Well, whatever your answer is, we want to hear from you. You can send emails to mail@kidsthesedays.org or comment on our website or message us on Facebook. Jennifer Aist joins the program today. Jennifer came to Alaska in 1993 for the adventure, and she says she stayed for the experience. Whether with her husband or her friends, Jen says she loves to travel and play in the Alaska backcountry along with her four children. She has logged hundreds of miles with her babies in her belly, on her back, and on her heels. Her book, Babes in the Woods, Hiking, Camping, and Backpacking with Babies and Young Children, was published in 2010 and was featured on Kids These Days in the fall of that same year. Jennifer has been a lactation consultant and parent educator for the past 20 years. She's passionate about babies, little kids, and our big backyard in Alaska. Thanks for coming back to Kids These Days today, Jen.
Thanks for having me.
And also with us this hour is Dr. Matthew Benson. Dr. Benson is a pediatric endocrinologist working with the Children's Hospital at Providence. He specializes in hormone disorders that can affect growth and development during all stages of childhood and adolescence. Dr. Benson is skilled in treating thyroid gland problems, growth disorders, early or delayed puberty, diabetes, obesity, low blood sugar, and disorders associated with vitamin D deficiency. Dr. Benson is one of only two pediatric endocrinologists located in Alaska, and he's participated in numerous research projects, including research to identify children at risk for vitamin D deficiency, an issue of particular importance to Alaskans. Thanks so much for being here, Dr. Benson.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I think for today's discussion, that's exactly where we need to start. We need to start with, why do we as Alaskans care about vitamin D, and how is it important to us, especially, I guess, any time of year, but right now the light is coming back, and how does that all relate?
Well, vitamin D is a very interesting, it's an interesting story, really. You know, in truth, it's really not a vitamin, actually. It's something that your body can make itself. And so by definition, it's not something that you require from your diet.
Okay.
But it's interesting in the sense that you can get vitamin D either from your diet or you can get it through the sun exposure. To get enough vitamin D from sun exposure, you need to have the sun being at the right latitude in the sky, and it needs to produce enough energy in your skin in order to induce the production of the vitamin so that your body can use it. And it actually in Alaska, very little, almost no time of the year do you really have any significant production of vitamin D, because even in the summertime when we have lots of light, most of the time you don't get enough to produce from your skin.
So. And that has to do, as you say, with where we are located on the planet and
yes.
How the sun rays hit us exactly where we live here in the state.
Exactly. And looking at a lot of the literature from people in Alaska, there's very little seasonal variation to people's vitamin D levels when we look at it. So, you know, if you get people who've obviously just come back from Hawaii and they've been exposed to lots of sun, well, they're obviously going to have a peak. But if you're spending your your winter and your summers mostly in Alaska, you're going to get very little vitamin D from the sun. Mm-hmm. Studies that have been done years ago demonstrated that you really need large portions of your body exposed to the sun, like big portions of your trunk and your back, and you need to be in the sun for at least an hour probably to generate enough vitamin D. And you make a lot of vitamin D, upwards of probably 10 to 20,000 units in that period of time.
And so when you say a big portion of your body, your torso, the back or the front, in that sun for an hour, is this a recipe for what we can do at certain times of year in Alaska? Or is that like if we lived in the lower 48 somewhere, that's what we could get? But here we're even challenged to get that?
I think we're challenged even to get that. So here in Alaska, I really think most everybody's at pretty high risk for vitamin D deficiency. And so I think it's important they think about dietary sources and supplements as a way to boost their vitamin D production. If you're a Alaska native people living on a native diet, that would be much better because they're eating a lot of salmon and fish that have high quantities of vitamin D. We talk about things like mushrooms, which there are a lot of those in Alaska. So if you're eating mushrooms, you probably could get some from that. The dietary sources other than that are quite limited.
So the ones that you just listed, there are mushrooms and salmon, you said, and other things that are things that we can find here easily.
Yes, and those would be good dietary sources. But in terms of how much vitamin D people need, that's still quite a bit. There's still some controversy around that. But in general, we think the average adult probably needs maybe about upper limits of 2,000 units a day. But the Institute of Medicine, which is gave some guidelines last year, they're saying maybe only 400 to 600 international units of vitamin D is adequate. But we know that lots of people in Alaska are deficient. Lots of the patients who I check have low levels. But there are also a lot of patients who are doing well, either because of their diet or because they're taking a supplement regularly.
Okay.
And I think most people either should make sure their diet's rich in sources of vitamin D and probably get additional supplementation if they need it.
Okay, and so there's some arguments still, it sounds like, about what is an effective amount. So anywhere between 400 to 2,000 international units a day, which you can take in supplements.
Depending on, the age of the child and whatnot.
Speaking for kids and adults, range. Okay.
Yes. Now, infants and children, if they can get 400 international units a day, that's probably enough to keep them vitamin D sufficient. Older children may potentially need more, but this is something that's still really being looked at. We talk a lot about what vitamin D does in the body, and for a long, long time we've known that it's vitally important for obviously calcium balance and for bone health, so to maintain your bone density, things like that. But we've learned a lot in the last 5 to 10 years. There's been an exponential increase in research looking at what is becoming known as non-classic effects of vitamin D. We're learning that vitamin D is important in the innate immune system, so helping your body to fight infections. Mm-hmm. For example, it's been known historically that tuberculosis patients did better when they were in sanatoriums, places where they're being exposed to a significant amount of light. We now know that vitamin D probably is responsible for that because it upregulates in the cell certain proteins that help your body kill infectious agents like tuberculosis in the body. So there's been some randomized studies, sound studies, very scientifically well done, that have shown that kids that are getting vitamin D supplementation in the winter seem to have lower rates of influenza. It's also been looked at in diseases like asthma, and we're starting to think about looking at it in terms of its ability to potentially prevent lung disease, pneumonia, things like that. So there's lots of research, and it's easy to make claims, but we have to still look for good, well-done, scientifically sound, proven studies to really say this definitely works. But in general, I think it's important if people look up the Institute of Medicine 2010 or the Endocrine Society, these are available on the internet. You can sort of get a general sense from that of where you should start as a baseline. And then, you know, if you're having other symptoms or you're concerned, then you could potentially have your level checked.
Mm-hmm. So that's interesting that you mentioned some of these other things that can be affected by vitamin D deficiency. You talk about how vitamin D is important when it comes to how our bodies handle calcium. Isn't that right?
Definitely.
Okay,
yeah.
But then there's these other things that you mentioned, like tuberculosis and asthma and so forth. And I wanted to mention that previously on this program on Kids These Days, our producer Sarah Gonzalez did produce a piece about vitamin D deficiency and how that may or may not affect asthma. Mm-hmm. And you can find that and link to it from our website at kidsthesedays.org. I'm speaking with Dr. Matthew Benson today, and also with Jen Aist. And Jen, I want to go to you for just a minute, because while I introduced you as the author of the book Babes in the Woods, you're also a lactation consultant. And there is an effort in terms of when you're counseling women as they're breastfeeding, that doesn't vitamin D have to be supplemented in there somewhere? And what kind of recommendations do you make as a lactation consultant for that?
Well, like Dr. Benson was saying, we do hear a lot of different guidelines as far as numbers for dosing. Not a lot of vitamin D transfers into the breast milk, into the baby. So you would have to, if you were trying to get the baby's sole source of vitamin D via breast milk, you would have to up mom's dose pretty high. One study was suggesting 6,000 IUs, in some studies even higher. And I don't know of anyone that's in common practice recommending that at this time. So there are little supplements that are made just for babies. There's one called Just D, which is Just D. So it doesn't have the vitamin A and the vitamin C in it as well. And it doesn't stain your clothing, which is a hidden bonus when they spit half of it up back all over you. So, but we do, we encourage moms to breastfeed, knowing that, and to supplement as necessary with vitamin D for themselves. But I don't make that recommendation to them. I refer them back to their doctor. I think what we should do and what insurance should cover would be a trip to, say, Maui once a month to get our fix.
Would that be enough? I mean, like, if you do that, many Alaskans who are able do that, get out, you know, of the state sometime in the dead of winter and go, you know, get themselves very sunburned on a beach somewhere. Right. Is that, you know, does that pump you up for the rest of the season or what?
It has transient effects on your levels of 25 hydroxy vitamin D, which is what we measure. That's sort of the storage form of vitamin D. It's a compound that probably has a half-life of about 6 to 12 weeks, so probably 2 to 3 months. So if you go get baked in the sun in Maui, first of all, that's an interesting thing as well, because we know that if you're sunburned, your body actually has ways of protecting you from vitamin D overproduction.
Oh, really?
When you're exposed to too much sun, your body controls for that so that you don't end up with vitamin D intoxication.
Oh.
So you have to be balanced. You know, there are some case reports coming out now with people being more concerned about vitamin D, that it is possible also to become intoxicated. So that's one aspect. But the second issue is that if you're so you're going to get some transient increase, obviously, in your vitamin D production, but it probably only be transient. It may only last a few months.
So tell me more about this vitamin D intoxication.
Well, if your levels get extremely high, most people are talking about levels above 100 nanogram per mL, the units that we typically measure it in. It can lead to elevated calcium in your urine. It can lead to elevated calcium in your blood. It could lead to seizures, things like that. Mm-hmm. And it's a very serious problem. When you become intoxicated with something that has a relatively long half-life in the body, you're talking about a problem, you know, that's difficult and challenging to deal with.
And just so that people who aren't that familiar with the idea and concept of half-life, that means it's something that if you get an overdose, it's not like you
can't
purge
get
your system
rid
of it right away. It takes a while to decrease over time.
It takes a while. But thankfully, that's very rare. It doesn't happen very often. There's few case reports. I think what people need to focus on is that in the United States of America, where we should easily be able to provide a supplement that costs pennies a day, we're seeing cases of nutritional rickets all over the country. And this is really alarming. Jen was talking about breastfeeding. Breastfeeding is absolutely the best thing a mother should do. There's a lot of, we know that many moms who breastfeed are deficient in vitamin D. And Bruce Hollis from the Medical University of South Carolina is a big researcher in the field's published studies. We're looking at the women who are nursing, and definitely women that are nursing, 2,000 to 4,000 units a day has been shown to be quite safe and effective. That'll help boost their vitamin D so that when their babies are born, their babies have adequate levels of vitamin D. And then if they continue supplementing with that, that'll help them have enough vitamin D in their breast milk to help their child. At the same time, I still would recommend, too, that if they can do it, something like Just D, or one I use, the BioDemulsion. It's a product that's available at some of the local pharmacies here in Anchorage. It's available in 400 unit per drop or 2,000 unit per drop. It's available. So, and it's not that expensive. You know, one bottle is going to cost you probably in the neighborhood of $10 to $15. And, that's for something that will probably last you 6 months, that to me seems fairly affordable. And I think on the other side, it's amazing that for something that is so relatively inexpensive, we're still seeing large numbers of people that are vitamin D deficient.
Now tell me about rickets. This is something that happens if you're vitamin D deficient, particularly in children. Is that the case?
Rickets is exclusively something that happens in growing children. There's different types of rickets, but with vitamin D deficient rickets, basically what happens is the bones become soft, they become misshaped, they get bowing of the legs, and they can present with hypocalcemia, with seizures. And it's something that's completely preventable if people supplement regularly like they're supposed to.
So it sounds like as parents, consult your pediatrician about how much vitamin D supplementing you might want to do. And Jen, you'd like to add to that?
Yeah, isn't it true also that wearing sunscreen blocks the absorption of the vitamin D?
Most definitely. Sunscreen really intoxicates you. I came up here from Florida, and when we were living in Florida, I'd let my kids go out in the sun for about a half hour to an hour in the middle of the day. Where we lived in Jacksonville, you only have significant vitamin D production between the hours of 10 and 2. We saw a lot of vitamin D deficiency in Florida. I did a study with 60 infants and toddlers. We found about 5% of them had vitamin D deficiency, and that's living in Northeast Florida. So there's different factors, different things that are impacting that. But you have to be out in the sun between 10 and 2. You have to expose a significant amount of your body to the sun to make enough vitamin D. And then I'd lather them up with sunscreen after that. There's different ways to do that. They should talk to their pediatrician about that when they're going to some of these places, because that, you know, we know you need some sun exposure. It's the way your body makes vitamin D. We also know that too much sun exposure is also not good. So you have to have a balance.
It sounds like a balance.
Yeah.
Well, this is a slight departure from the conversation that we've been having about vitamin D specifically and how that affects us in Alaska and what it does for our body and so forth. But I want to get to this before the end of this half of the show. If you head into any elementary school this time of year, and the chances are pretty good, you'll find a classroom with its windowsills lined with cups of dirt, green shoots just poking up. The daylight is back. Stores are full of gardening supplies and many conversations about it. And for many Alaskans, getting seeds started is one use for all of that spring fever energy we're talking about this hour. As Kids These Days contributor Jessica Cochran tells us, kids, dirt, and seeds are a natural combination.
Outside, the sun is shining, but the snow is piled high. Inside the Anchorage Municipal Greenhouse is a tropical oasis, warm and moist, full of plants, birds, and ladybugs. A dozen or more toddlers are gathered with their parents for story time with the flowers, a weekly event with story reading, songs, and craft time. The average kid age here appears to be about 2, so these youngsters haven't yet done a lot of gardening, but some of their parents have plans. Mom Emily is here with her 15-month-old son, Finn.
This summer we want to do some container gardening with him, just because we think it's really important to show him where our food comes from. So we'll talk to him when he's eating an apple. He'll see apple seeds in the apple, and we try to talk to him about, well, apples grow on trees, you know, they don't just come from the grocery store. So yeah, that connection is important to us.
That same desire drives Patrick Ryan's work. He's the education outreach coordinator for the Alaska Botanical Garden. He says there are plenty of projects even really young kids can enjoy. Among his favorites, garbage can gardening.
You know, when you're preparing carrots in the kitchen, you cut those tops off and put them in a little pebble tray, a little dish with marbles in there, and put water in there, and those carrot tops will sprout. And they're not going to last forever because they're cut off from the plant, but something green, and boy, is that nice to see in February. So little projects like that, we could call that garbage can gardening. There's so many things you can do with pits and roots and things from the grocery store in the kitchen, and it's like sprouting citrus seeds or ginger root, avocado pits, that kind of thing. So that's a great project. Pineapple tops.
Ryan taught first grade for many years and always grew things with his class. He suggests reusing containers from the grocery store, yogurt containers, those ones with clear lids from the deli, or the boxes some produce comes in. He says large seeds work best for younger kids.
So like nasturtiums or sunflowers, a good big seed to sprout quickly, and you'll see the results pretty fast. And they're not that particular about, you know, being pushed into the soil, whether they need light or a certain temperature. It's not that tough.
If you're starting them inside this time of year, they'll need some room. You won't be able to move them outside till close to the end of May. So he suggests sowing them thinly.
You don't have to worry about transplanting so much later. They have room to grow, and they can stay in that thing until they're ready to go outdoors. And the next key thing after not overwatering would be getting some light to them. So about mid-March, we have pretty good light if you have a good south-facing window. Otherwise, you might want to add some supplementary light so these plants don't get, as we call them, leggy. They stretch towards the light.
Ryan says it's not hard to integrate gardening into classroom learning. There are plenty of connections to literature. The Agriculture in the Classroom program is a national program aimed at increasing students' food literacy, knowing where food comes from. Its website includes state-specific lesson plans. Ryan teaches a junior master gardener program at the Alaska Botanical Garden in the summer for kids age 7 to 12. It's an in-depth 8-week program incorporating music, the flowers in the garden, and their own square foot garden plots. Southeast Alaska doesn't have a formal junior master gardener program, but there are plenty of other opportunities for kids to get involved with gardening beyond their own families. Darren Snyder is a UAF Cooperative Extension Service agent in Juneau. He runs a 4-H sustainable harvest camp in Juneau in the summer.
But that's wild harvest as well as cultivated harvest that we connect the kids to and give them the opportunity to get their hands dirty and learn about where their food's coming from and get a real sense of what it means to grow your own and what it takes to do that, and hopefully to instill some real appreciation for what we can grow here and how good it tastes when it comes out of the ground.
Snyder also supports 4-H clubs throughout Southeast. Juneau has a 4-H garden club. Other towns have 4-H outdoors clubs that include some gardening. Community gardens in the region may have kid components, plots dedicated to use by kids, maybe school groups in spring and fall, with clubs taking over in the summer. In Juneau, the Indian Education Program organizes gardens at some schools. They're taking advantage of the cultural connection to gardening.
The Tlingit have been cultivating a certain variety of potato for hundreds of years, and this potato was traded, presumably, through routes along the west coast all the way up from Chile. And nobody knows exactly sure its exact routes because that's kind of lost in history, but these were cultivated previous to European contact. And so this is a kind of a part of the story of the Tlingit history, and it's something that that people can connect to.
And Haines has an active school program.
And that's managed by a woman named Pam Randles. And so she has sixth graders who are in charge of this school composting project, and they recycle their cafeteria wastes and then use those nutrients from the compost in their garden.
People like Darren Snyder and Pat Ryan are there to teach more about gardening, to understand how to grow efficiently in Alaska's climates. But it doesn't take much to just get started. Some dirt and seeds, water and sunshine. I'm Jessica Cochran.
And I'm Shanna Sheehy, and this is Kids These Days, and today we're celebrating the change of seasons by talking about spring and this period of rebirth and rejuvenation. I'm joined in the studio today by Dr. Matthew Benson and Jen Aist. And Jen, I'd like to actually go to you first for a comment about that. Jessica says, you know, dirt and seeds and sun are what we need to make things grow. Your expertise, you have many of them, but one of them is for getting out in the outdoors. And does that, for you and your family, include gardening?
It does include gardening, and I've always wanted to do more with gardening. My problem is we tend to spend a lot of time in the backcountry, and so I need to find a way to garden that doesn't require me to garden all the time so I can leave it for a couple weeks and come back to it. But I think kids and dirt are just a totally natural mix. And even in the heart of winter in January and February, I think going to the botanical gardens and the greenhouses and story time in the greenhouse, I think is a really fabulous thing to do. And I think it's just a really wonderful program that they have going on there.
And Dr. Benson, any comments you might have after hearing that piece about gardening with kids?
Well, I think, I have three children and they love going out and learning about how plants grow and what it takes to help plants grow. But I think one thing that it does, just taking your kids out on trips like that and some of the things that Jen has proposed, is we really need our kids to be more active, to be having an understanding of sort of where food comes from. And I think they can learn science, they can learn math, they can learn so many other valuable things. It's ways for families to be together. I counsel so many kids these days about obesity and abnormal weight gain, and they're eating fast food constantly. Families aren't eating together. They're not talking together. And I think that's part of the reason we have so many issues in our society is, if the family is falling apart, breaking apart, they're not active, they're not engaged. And I think things like this are ways to get our families out being active because being involved in their community. And I just think that's a valuable thing for their development.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is Kids These Days, as we mentioned, and our conversation about spring will continue after a quick break. This program is a production of the Content Producers Guild, an independent membership organization. We're distributed and recorded through partnerships with the Alaska Public Radio Network and KSKA-FM in Anchorage. You're listening on listener-supported radio in your community. Hello to Dillingham, Kodiak, Haines, Skagway, and Klukwan, Anchorage and the Mat-Su, Juneau, and Chivac. You can find lots more Kids These Days stuff by checking us out online anytime. We're there 24/7 at kidstheseDays.org. Still to come this hour, we learn how our northern seasons may correlate to Alaska's high suicide rates. And Aaron Kirkland of KTD On The Go has some great spring skiing advice for you and the whole family. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Adolescence is a time when kids are changing and maturing a lot, and one part of that development is sexual development, when relationships and who is doing what with whom are some of the most important happenings in a teen's life. What happens when sexual identity is an issue? We'll ask that question next time on Kids These Days, and we'll get some celebrity advice and share a personal coming out story. That and more next time. We're back. I'm Shanna Sheehy, and Dr. Matthew Benson and Jen Aist join me today in the studio to talk about springtime, vitamin D, and getting outside. But first this. For many of us, more daylight and warmer temperatures are evidence of spring's annual promise of new beginnings. But for those of us who are depressed, springtime and all those ideas of hope that come along with it can be especially hard. So we thought it was a good time to find out if springtime really is a time when more people attempt and complete suicide. And since Alaska's suicide rate is nearly double that of the national average, knowing how you can help prevent suicide is always in season. Kate Buckhart is the Executive Director of the Statewide Suicide Prevention Council, the Alaska Mental Health Board, and the Advisory Board on Alcoholism and Drug Abuse. She recently spoke with Kids These Days producer Sarah Gonzalez.
Kate Buckhart, thank you for speaking with us on Kids These Days.
Thank you for having me.
So first off the bat, I want to ask you, is it a myth or is it not a myth that suicide rates tend to spike in the springtime?
Well, the answer to that question is yes and no. A review of suicide attempt data for a 9-year period here in Alaska between 2001 and 2008 showed that statewide we did see increased numbers and rates of suicide attempts in March and April, but also in January and October. When we looked at it by census area, however, only in 3 census areas did we see an increase in suicide attempts in the spring. In the rest of the state, we either saw no change or a decrease in the spring. And so it's not really easy or even appropriate to say that suicide rates in Alaska spike in the spring or increase in the spring, because what we see depending on the community and the region is very different.
Okay, so whether or not it's a myth, it's still a good time to raise some awareness about it.
Anytime is a good time to raise awareness about suicide prevention.
What are some of the prevention methods that you've found or hope will be effective when preventing suicide among Alaska's young population?
In the state suicide prevention plan, we focus on ways that both adults and youth can promote wellness. And so one of the strategies that our stakeholders found to be missing and that is very effective is that Alaskan adults and elders choose healthy, responsible lifestyles in order to serve as role models for younger generations. A correlate to that is the next strategy, which is that Alaskan youth will seek out healthy and appropriate relationships with role models in their community, whether it's through Big Brothers, Big Sisters, or a sports coach, or a pastor at church, or a teacher. We want young people to seek out those role models as well.
Is another part of prevention just talking about suicide? I mean, that could be said to be a myth too, that I think a lot of people might think that if you talk about suicide, you're putting the idea into somebody's mind.
A lot of people think that that's true. And there's research that actually shows that it's not true, that prevention and intervention programs that work with students in schools that actually expressly deal with the warning signs of suicide and how to seek help and how to go to a trusted adult if you or someone you know is feeling suicidal, that actually being very open and honest in those conversations promotes help seeking by young people, whereas not talking about it and keeping it secret encourages the stigma around suicide and depression and other associated mental health conditions, and it prevents help seeking.
So if you're a caring adult who is concerned about a young person, what are some questions that you can ask them to determine if they might be having suicidal thoughts or, to figure out how you might be able to help them?
Well, questions that relate to the warning signs are a good option. Warning signs that someone is at risk of suicide are comments about threatening to hurt themselves or kill themselves or wanting to hurt or kill themselves. If a young person makes a comment like that, don't just let it slide by. Ask questions and ask the hard question, are you thinking about killing yourself? You can't really dance around that question. You have to be brave and ask that question. Also, asking questions about whether or not the young person has been looking for ways to cause themselves harm or kill themselves, whether it's through access to firearms, medications, or other means. Another warning sign is talking or writing about death, dying, or suicide when those actions are out of the ordinary. Increased risky activities and putting yourself in a place to get hurt seemingly without thinking about it is a warning sign. Dramatic mood changes, whether they're for the worse, suddenly being depressed, or for the better, someone who seems suddenly very, very happy, uncharacteristically happy. Those dramatic mood changes, that's something that adults and mentors might want to ask questions about.
And what happens if they say, yeah, I'm thinking about it?
The resource that's available 24/7 here in Alaska is CareLine, and that is our suicide crisis intervention hotline. It's based in Fairbanks, and it's staffed by Alaskans. The number is 1-877-266-4357. And it's always staffed. On their website, carolinealaska.com, they also have a live chat function, which a lot of youth feel more comfortable with rather than talking directly with a crisis line staff person. Mm-hmm. The calls are confidential, and they can provide direct crisis intervention services if the caller is themselves feeling suicidal. Or they can provide resources and information to someone who's calling because they're worried about someone else. Okay. So that resource is always available. For teachers and coaches, the social work department in their school district is often a great resource. Our social workers in the Lower Kuskokwim School District and the Mat-Su School District and the Juneau Douglas School District and in Anchorage all are very engaged in suicide prevention and can be a great support for teachers.
That's great. And we'll also have all that information available on our website at kidsthesedays.org. So, Kate Burkhart, thank you so much for speaking to us about the state's effort for suicide prevention in Alaska.
Thank you. And folks can also access other information and training information at the state's suicide prevention website. It's stopsuicidealaska.org.
Okay, we'll have that on our website too. Thanks, Kate.
Thank you.
This is Kids These Days, and this is a weekly conversation about issues that affect us all as Alaskans and as members of our own families. Today, we're talking about springtime and some of the issues that come up during that period. How does the spring affect you and your kids? Tell us by writing to mail@kidsthesedays.org or by commenting right there on our website or on our Facebook page. I'm Shanna Sheehy, and with me in the studio this hour for our conversation are Jen Aist and Dr. Matthew Benson. And I have a question to ask you guys, but I first wanted to see if you have any response to the piece that Sarah Gonzalez produced for this program.
Well, it's something that's near and dear to my heart because I work with moms and every day. And 1 in 9 women suffer from postpartum depression. And we know, since we're talking about getting outside, that when women get outside, we reduce those symptoms of postpartum depression by at least 50%, if not more. But there's this big, I guess, like a fear hurdle to, well, I don't know how to do that with a baby, or I don't know how to do that with a little kid, or now I have 2 kids, and that's a really big challenge. And so that's really why I wrote my book, was to help people find a way to get outside safely, to engage in the outdoors, not with the intent that they all go and climb Denali, but rather with the intent that they get outside. And if that's walking around the block, if that's going to the park, if that is, for some women I work with, it's let's go to the mailbox today and back. And let's start there and move on from that. But it just makes such a difference. And not only for those women, but for those babies, because we really need moms to be present with their babies. And if they're not able to do that, if they're not in a state of mind, literally, where they can do that, then they're not engaging that baby during those critical periods of development in that first year of life. And so it's affecting the next generation as well. And so getting outside is just, it just needs to be an integral part of our lives, like it used to be. We used to live outside. This is a modern thing that we feel the need to stay inside all the time. And if you talk to people, I mean, we have a lot of snow outside right now, and I have a feeling we're going to have a lot of snow outside for a long time. And living up here in the north, you cannot allow snow to be your, I'm not going outside until the snow's gone. It's at least 6 months out of the year on a good year, and it could be 7 or 8 this year. I don't know the way that things are looking here. And if you talk to people who are grumbling about the winter versus people that are like, oh, great, I'm going to have another month to go cross-country skiing or sledding or ice skating or walking in the snow or whatever, the people that are okay with winter, they engage in winter. And the people that hate it and curse it and badmouth it, they don't go outside. So if you use it and you have fun with it, it's just this whole beautiful cascade, you know, circular sort of thing. And it's a good thing. It's good to get out.
And I want to ask you specifically about some of your recommendations for getting out this time of year. It's springtime. But first, I just wanted to make sure if Dr. Matthew Benson might want to make any comments about our piece that we prepared for the beginning of this.
Yeah, I think it's important that people just get out to be active in the community, to socialize with other people. I mean, we came up here from Florida nervous about the dark days.
I imagine.
And, you know, I started walking at the lunch hour, getting myself outside, getting some physical activity, going to Junior Nordic with my kids, Boy Scouts with my kids, things like that, where people are just out doing things mm-hmm. in the community. It really helps your state of mind. You know, people need to be in socializing and being active, and you can kind of kill two birds with one stone and do both those things. It's good for your mental health. It's good for your physical health. Mm-hmm. And I spend a lot of hours of my day now talking to families that are, you know, people are struggling with abnormal weight gain and obesity, and they're starting to worry about heart disease and strokes and diabetes and so many other things. And if people just started doing a little bit of extra physical activity and making some changes in their eating habits, you know, it has profound impacts on their health. And you don't have to lose major amounts of weight. You only have to lose really moderate amounts of weight, and you can significantly lower your risk of developing diseases like diabetes.
Mm-hmm. Well, Jen Ace, tell us, you know, what do you think? I mean, we have a special year this year. This program airs in many different communities, but I think most of them, with the exception of some of our Southeast communities, are, you know, standing in a whole lot of snow right now. And I'm sure in the mountains in Southeast, there's tons and tons of snow. So mm-hmm. what are your recommendations for families who have, you know, kids of all ages, from the youngest, from those little infants you're talking about, all the way through to teenagers? What are some of your recommendations for how to get outside in the springtime, especially in a year when there's so much snow? What's the best thing to try to bundle those kids up to do?
Yeah, just get some good rain gear or waterproof snow pants and just do it. And it can be, you know, introducing some activity into your kid's life can really be as simple as bringing some plastic trucks or shovels or buckets or whatever, sand toys from your Florida days, onto the back deck with the snow. And I think if you make it part of your daily routine, and every day we go outside and we play and we're active, you can't really be outside without being active, especially if it's cold out. It's kind of inherent that there's some movement. And I think the other piece is go out there with your kids and show them that you can have fun out there also, and you're setting an amazing example for your children, and you're getting all the same health benefits and mental benefits for yourself as well as parents. Some people I find, they have a hard time motivating to do it themselves. It can be a lot of work to dress a bunch of little kids. I am the first to say by 15 months, kids can put on their own snowsuits by
you
themselves.
Think 15 months, huh?
Oh,
you
yeah.
You have evidence to prove this?
I can, you give me a 15-month-old and I will have that kid in their own snowsuit. I guarantee it.
But the mittens themselves maybe comes later.
You know, mittens, just get a bunch of dog booties with Velcro, or just duct tape the suckers on, or sew it on, or just eliminate the whole hassle right there.
So permanent mittens.
I think they should be like survival suits where it's just one piece that you just kind of put them in and then it's done, and there's nothing here to mess with and negotiate with. But someone needs to design that and sew it, who can sew better than I can. But the other thing is, there's a lot of groups in a lot of communities. Homer's got a wonderful play group that they do outside. Anchorage has Taiga Trekkers and Skedaddle Kids. And these are groups of moms that are organizing largely through Meetup and Facebook and things like that. And every whatever, Tuesday or Thursday, they know at 10 o'clock this group is getting together. And so it strengthens numbers. I think it's motivating to have moms, and I shouldn't leave out dads because they're obviously important in this too, but for them to get together. And somehow if it's on your calendar with a time, you're more likely to do it. And if you're new to getting outside, I think that's a great way to do it. Once you do it and you realize it's easy and it's fun and it's not any more work, it actually makes your job as a mom 100 times easier, then it can fall into an everyday sort of routine.
I'd like to mention, since we're talking about getting outside with the whole family, I'd like to mention a web extra that we'll have available for all of you at kidsthesedays.org. It's a sample of how, when there is so much snow, as we have here in Anchorage where we are today for this program, how getting outside with the whole family, a couple of sleds, and a recently shoveled roof can take on form of fun all on its mm-hmm. own. And it's one of these don't necessarily try this without adult supervision kinds of things. But we'll have that at kidsthesedays.org for all of you to take a look at here in the next few days. So I like this, Jen, this idea of, you know, strength in numbers, and there are all sorts of different groups. If you happen to be in a community and you can't find one of these groups, have you ever started these groups on your own, or do you know women and men who have, and what advice might you have for getting one of those going?
Meetup is pretty popular as a one place to start. Facebook is another one. There's also the Children Children in Nature Network, Richard Louv's organization, they have, they call them nature playgroups or nature groups, something to that effect. And there's actually whole kits that are online that you can download and print off. I think they're even in Spanish. And it tells you everything that you would need to know to set up one of these little playgroups in your own community. There are a lot of them already out there across the state. Of course, there's always room for more. But I think it's a great thing.
Now, is there a cutoff, for example, at elementary schools and other schools or in daycare facilities? Oftentimes there'll be a cutoff for what's, you know, too cold of a day to go out. I know minus 10, for example, might be a cutoff that I've heard of. Is there, when you're a parent, when you're home or a caregiver in your home and you're thinking, I got to get the kids out of the house, it's springtime, but it's still really cold out there. Is there, you know, some sort of health related temperature cutoff for getting that kid outside where you really should be paying more attention and maybe not going? Or is that a myth? We're talking about myths today. Is that a myth?
Well, I recently posed this question on my Babes in the Woods Facebook page and got some interesting feedback because I have people that are likers, friends, followers, whatever you call it on Facebook, but they're across the country. And so one mom wrote back and said, I don't go out below 50. Above zero. We all kind of, you know, laughed in our own way.
Sorry.
But certainly the range is wide. And if it's too cold for me to go out there, then it's probably too cold for my kid. I had a patient once from Russia, and I asked her, she said all the babies slept out on the porch all year round in the little prams, you know, the big buggy things. And I said, well, how cold is too cold to sleep on the porch? And she said, I said, zero? Do they sleep outside when it's zero? Yes, babies sleep on porch. Great. So 10 below, they sleep on porch? Yes, babies sleep on porch. I'm go, so 35, 40 below. And she's getting angry with me now. And she's like, you know, you stupid American, why don't you understand this? Babies sleep outside on the porch. It doesn't matter what the weather is. The kid's bundled up, and they're probably healthier for it. So the trick, it's not so much, I mean, obviously, if it's windy and it's 60 below zero, we've got a little risk of frostbite. But if you're dressed properly, you're pretty good to go. You need to, you know, you need to dress right, and you need to move.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Benson, did you have something to add to that?
Yeah, for the most part, I think I would agree with that. I don't think there's any temperature at which most age kids, you know, would have trouble. Certainly babies, you know, they have big chubby cheeks and lots of fat from nursing. I mean, they can get a little bit of frostbite probably a little bit earlier. But in general, I think she's right. You know, I think we just have to, for the most part, bundle the kids up and get outside and try to be as active as possible. And I think there's lots of safe ways to do that.
Well, I'd like to mention this. So when we were developing the idea for the show and talking about springtime, the idea of spring fever came up. And this is something that among Kids These Days colleagues and I, we were talking about as something just like this kind of fervor that happens during this time of year when the light's coming back and you get a glimpse that spring and then quickly summer's on its way, but it's not here yet. So it's sort of this time of, it's a fun time for a lot of people, but it's kind of a time of like a lot of energy, maybe even pent up energy. So I started looking around at spring fever and trying to find out more about spring fever. And I'd like to read from, this is a Wikipedia definition of what it is. So spring fever, quoting here, is a term applied to several sets of physical and psychological symptoms associated with the arrival of spring. In general, it refers to an increase in energy, vitality, and particularly sexual appetite, often particularly strong in those suffering from seasonal affective disorder. And thus, they're experiencing low parts of this in the winter months. And in some uses, however, it refers to the opposite, an unexpected loss of energy with the onset of spring. And so then we were looking around like, you know, is spring fever a thing? And there was a Scientific American article that we found exploring whether or not spring fever is fact or fiction. And basically the conclusion, we'll link to this from our website at kidsthesedays.org, but just to spoiler alert, I'm about to spoil the article. They basically say that there is a large body of evidence that says that energy levels do change during this time of year, but whether or not there's truly a spring fever, it's not in the DSM. So I'm wondering from the both of you, you know, spring fever, first of all, is it maybe different in Alaska since that idea of sexual vitality wasn't the first thing that came to the minds of the Kids These Days team? And when I mentioned it to you before we got the program underway, you know, it seemed like that part of the concept, at least for you, Jen, who's been in Alaska for a while, wasn't something that first came to mind. Do we have a special kind of spring fever maybe in Alaska? That's the question I'm trying to ask.
Well, I don't know. I've maybe been here too long to know.
Yeah, maybe
you're a newbie to Alaska.
Yeah, I don't know. I certainly have enjoyed the longer daylight, and you certainly have just the last week or two. It seems like the sky's opening up and the days are getting longer, and you know, it's in the 30s this week, so I guess we're warming up.
Yeah, the 30s. It sounds very, very warm. We put on a down jacket last night. My husband said, I'm not sure you really want to wear that if you're going for a walk. It might be a little too warm.
You know, I bike to work, and it's really nice because I almost don't even need my bike light riding to work now, which is fun.
So you don't need to illuminate the trail in front of you to get there. You actually have light coming.
Yeah, anyway. It's an odd thing to be excited about, but it does something for me.
I mean, is that part of it because we have such drastic changes in light? You know, about March, maybe even starting in February, this is my recollection. That's when I start to really notice in my daily routine that the light's coming back, and that affects me. I guess I'm wondering, like, I don't know that I'm alone, so I have the two of you in here to tell me whether or not that's also something that you all experience. And with the families that you see, is that something that's experienced?
Well, I don't have one bit of scientific evidence to back this up, and so I always kind of hesitate when I preface what I'm going to say with that kind of statement. But I do think that there is a group of babies who do not sleep as well starting this time of year. And for babies that are born like now, like in March and April, I just had a patient in this morning, and they were saying the baby's days and nights were kind of flipped, you know, opposites, which is typical for a brand newborn baby. But I told them, I said, you know, this time of year, you need to flip this around here pretty quick. Because if you baby's born in June with that 24-hour light, I think it does affect some of them. And again, I don't have any research to back that up. That is a 100% Jen observation of 20 years working with little babies. But I think it does affect kids some.
And Dr. Benson, as a pediatric endocrinologist, and you know, you're studying, or you're looking at hormones and different disorders and so forth in kids that come from imbalances of that nature. Like, does what we're talking about, spring fever, as it relates to Alaskans, does that ever come into play in your practice and the patients you see?
I'm sure to some degree. I mean, there are patients that come in and talking about their mood, or you know, they're depressed in the winter, they don't want to go outside, I'm concerned that maybe they're overall clinically depressed. So yeah, I think daylight has something to do with that. Recently, I was at a conference last fall at ANMC, and there was an ophthalmologist speaking, and they've learned about how there's light receptors as well now in the front of your eyes, and how they feed back to different portions of the brain. So I'm sure there's some biochemistry at work here with how our body needs light and expects to see light at certain times. But at the same time, I think the amazing thing about the human, our nature itself, I mean, people can adapt in a lot of different environments. And with some of the things Jen has talked about, with enabling people just to get out and be engaged, I don't think they have to be necessarily defined by that. And I think we need people, parents, to be engaged in playing with their kids. We need parents talking to their kids. We need kids talking to their teachers. We talked about kids having mentors, or talking to your pastor, your priest, your rabbi, other people in your life that are important to you. And I think if we as a community and as families, we start talking to each other, and we try to eat together, and we try to go play and have fun together, I think these are things that can in general just be much better for our health. And if you have a kid that's depressed or that's struggling, you know, you're engaged with them. You're in a relationship with them. You're not just like two boats passing in the night. You don't see each other. You're not engaged. You're not doing stuff together. So whatever we can do to try to promote that within families, and even families where it's parents are divorced or different issues going on. I mean, this needs to happen. It needs to be encouraged. And if we're talking to our kids, there's a lot of good positive things that can come out of that.
And I'd like to thank both of you so much for being on the program today. Jen Aist is the author of Babes in the Woods, Hiking, Camping, and Backpacking with Babies and Young Children. She's also a lactation consultant with Providence, Alaska. Thanks so much for being with us today, Jen.
It's my pleasure.
And also with us is Dr. Matthew Benson. He's a pediatric endocrinologist, and he works at the Children's Hospital at Providence. Thanks so much for coming.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
We will link to all those resources from kidsthesedays.org, and we'll also link to Dr. Benson's clinic. Clinic at Providence Alaska Medical Center, and Jen Aist, who previously joined us to talk at length about her book, Babes in the Woods, Hiking, Camping, and Backpacking with Babies and Young Children. We'll link to that program as well from our site so that you can listen to that if you wish. As we've learned today, it can be hard to get out and about in an Alaska spring. It seems like forever waiting for the snow to melt. Our KTD On The Go mom, Erin Kirkland, has a suggestion. Just embrace it.
This is Erin Kirkland, Kids These Days On The Go contributor. When the producer asked me to talk about spring skiing, the first thing that came to my mind was, really? One of the snowiest Alaskan winters ever? And you want me to try and sell parents on skiing just when we're all dreaming about flip-flops and shorts? Couldn't I talk about something else? Something perhaps with a sandy, surfy, beachy sort of feeling to it? March and April are often really difficult months to encourage outdoor recreation with kids. Snow is either melting, or as is the case this year, still falling, even as the weather warms up. Most parents are truly weary of snowsuits, soggy boots, and misplaced mittens. Even the name for this season is a downer. Breakup. Hey, enough whimpering. Let's go skiing. That's right, skiing. Snow fell and now it's lying all over the ground in record amounts. We might as well go outside and enjoy it. Actually, to be perfectly honest, if ever there was a favorite time to ski with my kids, it would be during the spring season, especially in Alaska, and especially this year. I love to step outdoors just about now and feel the difference between winter and spring. Snow is softer, a bit tired looking, but still gracious enough to welcome my skis upon its grainy surface. The air is fresh with the scent of spruce tips, and the sky on a bluebird afternoon looks like it was painted that way just for me. Alpine skiing families can take advantage of spring specials all around the state, making deals on everything from lift tickets to rentals to lessons. Kids are less likely to freeze fingers and toes on the chairlift, too. Alyeska Resort in Girdwood or Eagle Crest Resort in Juneau both offer great lesson lift packages that often include the gear, too. Nordic skiers definitely should find a delicious-looking trail, groomed to corduroy perfection, and head out to become one with the forest and their kids. Whether it's the wide expanse of Creamer's Field in Fairbanks or the forested loops of the Campbell Tract in Anchorage, an adventure among the dripping, sweet-smelling trees and chattering chickadees is a blessing indeed. Go for the experience. Go because it's springtime and snowy. Go because this is Alaska. For Kids These Days, I'm Erin Kirkland.
Find other KTD On The Go segments by Erin Kirkland and link to her own blog, AK On The Go, and her blog with us, all at kidsthesedays.org. That's it for today's show. You can find the full program on our website and listen again or share it with others. Or subscribe to our podcast and get our shows delivered to your phone or tablet without any effort at all. Erin Kirkland contributed to today's program. Jessica Cochran reported from Anchorage and is our technical editor. Sarah Gonzalez is our producer, web content editor, and business manager. Special thanks to all the dedicated board members of the Content Producers Guild. The work you do makes what we do on the air possible. I'm Shannon Sheehy. Thanks for spending time with me today, and I'll see you next week.
Kids These Days is an independent production of the Content Producers Guild. The opinions shared on the program are those of the host, guest, and contributors and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of KTD producers, partners, or funders. Major funding for Kids These Days comes from the Association of Alaska School Boards and its Initiative for Community Engagement. The program is made in partnership with KSKA-FM in Anchorage and the Alaska Public Radio Network. Find out more about Kids These Days anytime at kidsthesedays.org.